Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast with an explosion at the front.
Yes.
It's been saved.
It's a party in the front and boring in the back.
That's party all the way through, man.
Oh, okay.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a film critic. I am a writer for Slash Film, right over there rather extensively. And with me, as always, is my far more intelligent and scintillating co-host.
Yeah.
William, why don't you introduce yourself?
Weird to have a co-host who's a liar. But my name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Rep. And everybody calls me Bibbs. And yeah, we're back with more Critically Acclaimed. This is our movie review podcast where we review the newest releases. And this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the newest releases. We are reviewing...
What are we reviewing?
This week we are reviewing... I think we're a little late to the action on this one, but Star Trek Section 31.
Yes.
Which is the new made for Paramount Plus Star Trek movie, a spinoff of Star Trek Discovery. The animated family movie Dog Man. The comedy horror thriller Companion. I assume not comedy Steven Soderbergh horror movie Presence.
Yes, Ghost Story.
And the sci-fi love story Love Me, starring Kristen Stewart and Steven Yeun as a satellite and a flotation boy that fall in love after humanity dies.
Sounds amazing.
It's a good pitch. I'll tell you that right now.
I'm intrigued.
Mm. We'd like to start with the biggest movie of the week, but, well, that's probably Dog Man when it comes to, like, theatrical grosses.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of nerddom, we'd be remiss if we didn't start with Star Trek Section 31.
We'll have to start. We have a Star Trek podcast, yeah. So we're Trekkies through and through.
It's a Patreon exclusive. It's called All Our Yesterdays. We review every episode of Star Trek in order. We've got hundreds of episodes in the can already, and yeah, we recently just started doing Deep Space Nine.
That's right. We're that far along in the history of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And now we get to the most recent film. This is the 14th feature film to be spun off of Star Trek.
Yep.
This one specifically comes from the Kurtzman-verse.
Yeah.
Alex Kurtzman took over Star Trek and launched it, like relaunched the whole franchise in 2017 with the launch of CBS All Access, which became Paramount Plus.
Right.
The premier show, the flagship of this new Star Trek universe was Star Trek Discovery.
Mm.
A show that was initially created by Brian Fuller and was taken away from him and monkeyed with by a lot of different producers.
Pretty much right after, like, the first episode. And to be clear, Alex Kurtzman also co-wrote the J.J. Abrams movie as well. But correct me if I'm wrong here, because this is something, even as a Trekkie, I'm less of a Trekkie than you. I know less than you. This still confuses me. Is Star Trek Discovery...
Mm-hmm.
A completely alternate timeline? Is it a prequel to the original series and Next Generation as we know them? Or is it a prequel to the J.J. Abrams movies? Or some other weird thing that I can't even fathom?
Well, there was some debate on this.
Mm-hmm.
The reason the J.J. Abrams films got made was because of Janet Jackson. Stay with me on this.
I happen to know that this is true, but what an intro.
This is an interesting story. For the longest time, Paramount and its parent company, Viacom...
Its Paramount Company.
Paramount Company, Viacom, owned Star Trek. And that held true throughout sort of its glory days in the 90s.
Yeah.
The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and then even into the 2000s with Enterprise.
Mm.
Then came that Super Bowl incident. Now, the Super Bowl was being broadcasted by a subsidiary of Viacom.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the big scandal where Justin Timberlake removed a piece of Janet Jackson's clothing and exposed her on television.
Yeah, in the midst of the Super Bowl halftime show. During the Super Bowl right halftime at the end of it. Yeah. Yeah, and there was some debate over whether or not it was scripted or not.
Yeah.
Justin Timberlake noped out of that controversy and let Janet Jackson fall on her sword, by the way. I'm still mad about it.
Janet Jackson, by the way, doing fine.
She
weathered it well. And whether or not it was staged, you can debate that if you like. What happened, though, was the TV station got a lot of angry letters.
Yeah.
The term wardrobe malfunction became part of the lexicon. Mm. And there was so much bad blood within the company that the president of Viacom, I think it was Les Moonves, decided...
No, it was more Moonves.
Oh, my God. There was a big schism within the company, and they decided to split the CBS arm of the company and the Paramount arm of the company. So
so it was like the Parent Trap.
Pretty much. Yeah. Well, each
parent got a different child.
More or less.
And then when they finally met, chaos. Yeah.
One of them got a lot of the TV stuff, a lot of the MTV, a lot of the Nickelodeon, and the other one got all of the movie stuff, the Paramount stuff.
Yeah.
The problem with that was the CBS arm had all of the rights, all the TV rights to Star Trek, whereas the Paramount arm had all of the movie rights to Star Trek.
Right.
So if they wanted to make a new movie, they essentially had to license the Star Trek brand from within their own company.
Yeah.
And it was around that time that the TV arm and they would also have to make a deal with Paramount in order to make new TV shows. So,
right. Everything got more complicated.
Yeah, exactly. Just legally, they had to start cross-licensing within the company. CBS, in order to make profit off of Star Trek, decided to repackage all of Star Trek on DVD. They decided to start shopping the show around on streaming channels, which were kind of a novelty at the time.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the market was flooded with all this Star Trek. The reason we have all of those, access to all of those Star Trek DVDs, Janet Jackson.
Thanks, Janet.
And Paramount, the only way they could make money and market new toys and new kind of merch was to...
Make movies. Yeah.
The problem was, because the license was owned by another half of the company, it had to be, quote, legally distinct from the ordinary Star Trek.
Right.
So they could use the names Captain Kirk and USS Enterprise, but they couldn't look like the ones we knew from the TV show.
Right.
Hence the creation of an alternate timeline within the Star Trek universe, the Kelvinverse. So everything within the Kelvin movies had to be legally distinct. If you recall in the Kelvinverse, however, this is going to get even nerdier. There is a scene, a flashback scene, where we get to meet Spock, played by Leonard Nimoy, back in the original Star Trek timeline. Was that, and they referred to that as the prime timeline. That's sort of like a... And they
because Star Trek aired in prime time.
No, just the primary timeline.
Star Trek didn't air in prime time?
It did. It was a prime
time. So I was right.
Yes. But that's not why it's called the prime timeline.
That's one of the reasons.
It's not kind of the prime time line.
It doesn't disprove my theory.
I suppose, what is your theory? I'm confused now.
My theory is that at some point someone could have said, Star Trek was in prime time, let's keep it. it might have occurred to somebody down the line.
Given the intelligence of a lot of recent Star Trek writing, that doesn't strike me as unlikely.
Yeah.
So some fans have argued that because the whole film needed to be legally distinct, that all of the stuff from the quote prime timeline was not part of the original Star Trek timeline, that it was another a tertiary alternate dimension altogether.
Yeah, the so-called Kelvinverse is what the movies were called, because the destruction of the USS Kelvin at the beginning of...
Split it into a new dimension.
Created a new timeline.
The whole J.J. Abrams, that there were three J.J. Abrams films set in this alternate timeline, but when they finally got around to making CBS All Access, Star Trek Discovery was supposed to be true Star Trek again.
Okay, back to the original. Okay.
So it takes place in the same continuity as all the other shows that came before it, but just the TV shows, not the Kelvin movies, and the original 10 movies.
Yeah. But
but
they also dinked around with a lot of things.
Because they had a bigger budget and they wanted to sort of make it look distinct just aesthetically.
Well, they wanted to capture the cinematic look of the J.J. Abrams movies. There was a lot of lens flare. The production design was very similar to the Abrams verse.
One of the co-screenwriters of the Abrams movies, Alex Kurtzman, took over. He became the new Rick Berman, essentially, the executive producer of everything that was going on. Yeah. And I don't know what he gets out of Star Trek, honestly, because all of the shows he has overseen have very deliberately eschewed the kind of stodgy classicism, if you were, the kind of diplomatic underpinnings of a lot of the original Star Trek shows.
Yeah. Which in a vacuum is fine.
It's fine. A franchise needs to continue to grow and evolve as time goes on. You know, okay, they're like redesigning certain alien species. They're changing the way ships look and move. All of that's fine because they need to update it for a new medium.
Yeah.
I don't even have a big issue with the way they redesigned the Klingons. I don't necessarily like the new design, but I think it's okay that they tried to do that because they did that from the original show to Next Generation.
No,
that's
true. There's precedent for it. It's hard to complain when it's, they changed it from the stuff that they changed it to.
Yeah.
Okay, like, well, I can only get so mad, I suppose.
Of course,
you know?
Since then, they've kind of walked it back, and the Klingons now look more like they did in Next Generation.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
Because they just didn't like the design. They just went back.
It's
like all of a sudden, like they have, like onyx black skin and no hair and extra nostrils. And it's like they look, and their eyes are different. They look completely different.
Yeah.
But again, I'm okay with all of this. Then they invent, we finally, but they tried to do sort of the modern TV approach where they took an entire season and told one gigantic, very, eventful story arc.
Yeah. Instead of the episodic structure, which Star Trek usually had to that date. Where every episode was a new adventure, maybe there was some character stuff.
It took many episodes to finally get to the USS Discovery, which the show was named after. Mm-hmm. And the USS Discovery had invented this new technology, which allowed it to teleport anywhere in the universe.
Yeah.
Which is such a dramatic sea change for the world of Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, a show about trekking.
Yeah. It was a prequel, no less. So, like, how did this technology change everything that we'd seen before? So they had to write themselves into and out of corners constantly
all the time.
Just to justify the existence of the show that they made up. They didn't have to make it that way. But to be clear, to get back to focus on my question.
Yes.
Is Discovery its own thing? Is it part of the Kelvinverse? Is it part of the original timeline? Or is it still unclear?
It's the original timeline, but I think a lot of like old world Trekkies take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. Because it's sort of this brand new production team and a brand new creative team, which has a handful of writers, a handful of directors, and an army of producers.
Yeah.
Like, there are literally 21 producer credits at the head of every episode of Star Trek Discovery. Too many cooks in this one.
On the other hand, they're all getting work.
I'm not sure if the producers are getting work.
Not sure. Like, a lot of times when you're like, listed as a producer, it could be a legacy credit.
Yeah.
Like, Brian Fuller's still listed as a producer because he produced the pilot.
Yeah.
You know, he isn't working on it anymore. He hasn't worked on it since. Yeah.
Sam Simon is credited as a producer on The Simpsons. He died years ago. He's still getting a credit.
He's contractually obligated because he's part of the formation of the thing.
Fun bit of side trivia about The Simpsons. Sam Simon was briefly married to Jennifer Tilly, the actress.
Oh, that's cool.
And when they split up, one of the stipulations of the divorce was that she get 30% of his Simpsons money as long as he's credited on the show. She is so fucking rich.
Yeah, no wonder she's playing poker all the time. She can afford to lose it.
She can do whatever she wants. She doesn't have to work.
So,
but anyway, Jennifer Tilly aside.
I think we could dedicate this entire podcast to Jennifer Tilly.
Most podcasts could be dedicated to Jennifer Tilly.
But I digress. Okay, let's get back to Section 31 now, because this is a whole fucking can of worms. Now, so this movie is definitely in the Discoveryverse, which is kind of the original universe, but kind of. Hang on. We're just gonna let it go. We're gonna like it. Right. It's kind of in the original universe, but it's kind of its own thing. Here's the deal. Back in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which was on in the 1990s, they introduced a concept to Star Trek called Section 31, which was essentially the Black Ops CIA unit of the Federation. The Federation is supposed to be this egalitarian diplomatic entity that doesn't do that kind of thing. And indeed, the very existence of Section 31 was a closely held secret that only a few people even knew about.
Yeah.
But they do the stuff that they're not supposed to be doing. Spy work, yeah, assassinations.
And he, that is the agent from Section 31, is played by William Sadler on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Sort of
served... had previously been a Q, so maybe that explains it.
He wasn't a Q.
Wasn't William Sadler a Q in that episode where Q lost his powers?
That wasn't William Sadler.
Who was that?
I forgot the actor's name, but it wasn't William Sadler.
It was William Sadler.
No, he was like a TV veteran, but no, it was not William Sadler.
Okay, all right. Shut my mouth, I guess.
But, yeah, the function of Section 31 on Deep Space Nine was to reveal kind of a moral rot within the Federation. It was to test Dr. Bashir's moral compass a little bit. Like because they were trying to recruit the character of Dr. Bashir into Section 31. It's like, you get to do black ops stuff. And he said, that's not moral.
Yeah.
We don't get to do that.
It was Corbin Burnson.
Corbin Burnson.
I can see how I confused the two. Okay.
Anyway, it was always seen as something very shadowy and something incredibly unfortunate that Star Trek, that the Federation felt they needed to resort to shady murders in order to keep the status quo.
It's a portrayal of, it's a betrayal of their ideals. Yeah. It's a betrayal of Roddenberry's concept of the future. It is a bad thing that it exists. Cut to like 30 years later now, and it's cool.
It's super cool.
It's the best part of Star Trek. Everyone gets to wear leather and swear.
No, it's Suicide Squad. The main character in this new Section 31 movie is Empress Philippa Georgiou, played by Michelle Yeoh.
And if you haven't been following Star Trek, that's a whole can of fucking worms.
Yeah.
In short, there's a mirror universe.
She's from the evil mirror universe that most, even non-Trekkies, know about the mirror universe because of Spock with a goatee.
Basically, there's an alternate reality where every good guy is evil. She was a character who died in like the first couple episodes of Discovery, a heroic character, but her evil doppelganger was a genocidal tyrant who ruled the Federation, or the Terran Empire.
The Terran Empire,
As they call it in the alternate universe. So she was basically Space Hitler.
Yeah.
And then she came over to our reality, and she kind of found her conscience. But she's also kind of still Space Hitler.
A bit, because...
Martial arts Space Hitler, played by Michelle Yeoh, might be redemptive. Is a weird pitch.
It's a weird pitch.
I'm not sure it's a good one, but it's weird.
And the timeline of the whole thing is weird because, you know, Discovery ended up, like, visiting the 32nd century, which is, like, almost 1,000 years after the ordinary Star Trek events.
But she developed, like, a time flu and had to go back closer to the next generation timeline in order to survive.
Although they mix it up because the star date they give is close to the next generation timeline, but the actual year they give is closer to the original Star Trek, and those are set about a century apart.
In the movie, you mean?
In Section 31.
Oh, God damn it, that's so annoying.
So there's like 60 to 70 years that are unaccounted for. They don't have the timeline quite right in this movie, but that's only stuff nerds will notice.
Yeah.
Stuff non-nerds will notice is how shitty the movie is.
Okay. I'm gonna explain something right now. I've seen this movie, and I am going to do my best to refrain from officially like reviewing it and getting very opinionated about it, because I know someone who worked on the project.
Okay.
They worked on it back when it was a TV series, and then it gradually got shortened to a mini series, and then it became a movie. And as my understanding, his work had very little of it made it into the movie, if anything, and he doesn't care. But for me, I think it is my responsibility to nope out of stuff like that. But I can talk about observations.
Okay.
I can talk about context. I can talk about what it means to the rest of the franchise. I can make sort of neutral statements, but I'm going to try to refrain from being opinionated because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm overreacting, but it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and you mentioned this was going to be a TV series, Section 31, starring Michelle Yeoh. Alex Kurtzman has said in interviews it was after she won an Oscar that she said she's not going to do TV anymore.
Yeah.
She didn't want to do a whole series, so they decided to shorten this series into a single TV movie. It's the first TV movie that Star Trek has done, unless you want to count Dark Horizon, the 2-hour episode of Star Trek Voyager. Came out, I think, the show's fifth season.
Was that like marketed separately as like Star Trek Voyager, Dark Horizon? Or was it just a two-parter?
They called it Star Trek Voyager, Dark Horizon. That's the way they marketed it. And they aired it in one gigantic chunk.
Yeah. So the irony is that although this is now like a movie and a standalone movie.
Excuse me, Dark Frontier.
Dark Frontier, okay. This is a movie or standalone movie. It plays like a backdoor pilot.
Mm.
It's very, very much, we're introducing a whole bunch of characters, they're a ragtag group of misfits, and by the end of it, not everyone survives, it's that kind of Suicide Squad-y Dirty Dozen type movie, but the implication is, and if you like this, maybe the adventure will continue, if Michelle Yeoh decides she wants to do TV again.
Right.
Yeah, basically. But yeah, it does, it never, because here's the thing with Star Trek makes a movie. Because there's so much Star Trek on TV. Mm. And the Star Trek on TV, you know, it can be cheap, but it is still epic. You're traveling the stars, you're meeting aliens, it's still fundamentally kind of
depends on the budget that week, but yes.
Yeah, but even a low-budget episode can have an epic concept, for example. So when they make a Star Trek movie, the temptation, and I get it, is to try to make it as cinematic as possible. Make it as big as possible. Make it exciting and visual effects driven.
Make the stakes really high.
Yeah.
And make the story conclude in a very splashy way. Mm-hmm. Rather unfortunately, a lot of the Star Trek movies, even ones I like, tend to fall into really kind of tired action tropes.
Yeah.
To make their films seem kind of bigger and more epic.
And one of the
bigger explosions, bigger fights, that kind of
stuff.
And
one of the best things about Star Trek, and I think one of the reasons why Star Trek still thrives all these years later, is that Star Trek is a very malleable premise. Mm. You can do almost anything in Star Trek. There are certain rules by which we have to abide, but they break those sometimes too. Mm. But yeah, you can do a big action spectacular Star Trek, but that's not all Star Trek is. You can also do really heady, talky sci-fi Star Trek. That works too. You can do a character-driven bit. You can do a fucking musical. Like, you can do it all. It's all a delivery system for any kind of story you want to tell, but most of the movies tend to be the same type of story.
Yeah, there's five of the Star Trek movies in a row have involved as a central part of their plot a bad guy who wants revenge. And several of them have had, like, doomsday weapons. They actually use the word super weapon in dialogue in Section 31.
Okay, listen, sometimes
that's a screenwriting term.
I understand that. It's still accurate.
Early in Star Trek Discovery, when Philippa Georgiou was going back, like, leaving Star Trek Discovery and going off on her own adventures, one character referred to the mirror timeline and the prime timeline. Those are fan terms that we made up to describe those things that are now just as part of dialogue.
I thought they called it the mirror universe in Universe. Didn't they call that in Discovery?
In Discovery they started calling it the mirror universe. Because it was named after an episode called Mirror Mirror.
Yeah, but come on. When are you supposed to just make up some random thing when everyone already calls it something?
The fans call it
that. My point is this. Why come up with a new... It's sort of like when... when Thanos killed half the Marvel Cinematic Universe with a snap of his fingers, fans called it the snap. Mm. Who survived the snap? What happened after the snap? But then when Spider-Man Far From Home came out, we find out that people within the universe called it the blip.
Yes.
That's completely unnecessary. Like, we already called it a thing. You're just trying to get it to rebrand.
We called it a thing.
I understand that, but it's a perfectly good term. There's no reason something to muck it up.
The mirror universe in the... Anyway, that bothers me, but I'm a nerd.
It's fine. Anyway, I had something else I was going to say, and I got lost.
We can get into this movie now.
Okay.
So, yeah, the premise of this is that
I was trying to count the revenge movies. Hang on, real fast. So it's this one, Star Trek 1 through 3, the J.J. Abrams movies.
Yes.
Because that was Eric Bana, was it Idris Elba? Yeah, and then Benedict Cumberbatch and Idris Elba.
Yeah. Benedict Cumberbatch? It was Admiral...
But he wasn't getting revenge. Marcus wasn't getting revenge, though. Only Benedict Cumberbatch wanted to get revenge.
He was piloting a ship called the USS Vengeance.
Okay,
he was getting revenge.
Technically, yes, but not for anything specific. It's not like they killed his daughter or anything. But then we go back to Nemesis.
Star Trek Nemesis.
Back to F. Murray Abraham and Insurrection. He's getting revenge on the planet that, like, jettisoned him, and now his people are dying.
Well, that was
so
more...
that's six in a row.
That was more about Picard trying to rescue the people.
Yeah, but still, the villain's motivation was revenge.
No, it wasn't revenge.
He wanted that fucking planet. He wanted to get them off. He wanted to take everything they had. His people were, like, thrown off of that planet, and then they were dying because of it. So yeah, he's manipulating things to kick people off the planet.
It wasn't quite the same thing, but...
All right.
Okay, but
and then Picard wanted revenge against the Borg.
sure.
Yeah. So there you go. And then Malcolm McDowell wanted revenge against the giant negative space wedgie.
No, he wanted to get into the giant negative space wedgie.
Well, his emotions were complicated about it. It's a love-hate kind of thing.
he secretly hated the Nexus.
Yes.
Problem is, it's a problem that we rely on super weapons and vengeance, mm-hmm. These kind of action tropes when we're making Star Trek movies.
Because we're just copying Wrath of Khan over and over again.
At some point after Star Trek VI came out, that's when sort of this fan consensus started to gel that Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan was the one. It's like the best one that everybody loved the most. And that an argument can be made.
A lot of people love that movie.
A lot of people do love that movie.
Arguably saved the franchise.
Yeah.
You know, it was a hit, so keep going.
But I feel like Alex Kurtzman looked at Star Trek and thought, I don't like that. And I've heard him talk about Section 31 in interviews, and he talks about how, you can't have a utopia without violence percolating underneath it.
Then it's a dystopia.
Then it's not a utopia, is it?
Yeah, then you've missed the point. Yeah, completely.
So I think he doesn't understand or doesn't believe in the kind of utopia that Star Trek ostensibly is trying to argue for.
Well, because I would argue that in principle, like, you know, a lot of things that happen in Star Trek are, we have these ideals, we have ostensibly a utopia, but we have to constantly keep fighting for it.
Yeah.
So when things pop up, when an admiral goes rogue, when something happens, that has to be, we have to put a stop to that. Mm. But the existence of, the continued perpetual existence of Section 31 from like original series timeline
onward
is a prolonged, you know, black mark on the permanent record. So that actually defies the Star Trek premise. I can't imagine Roddenberry being happy about it.
No, Roddenberry,
not that he had to be.
I'm okay with it with the way it was presented in Deep Space Nine because it was constantly presented repeatedly as a black mark on the Federation and how it needed to be gotten rid of.
Yeah.
Alex Kurtzman seems to think it's the bee's knees. He really likes this idea. So the idea is that Empress Philippa Georgia went through a time portal, wound up vaguely somewhere in the Next Generation timeline.
At least, I think like 20 years before, something like that, because there's a character who recurs.
There's a character who would grow up to captain the Enterprise C.
Yeah.
Who would in turn like be thrown forward in time.
Yeah.
But it's at least a few decades before, she's a younger woman in this story. But she went back in time and was recruited by Section 31.
Yeah.
To do the Federation's dirty work. First of all, I hate the idea that the Federation has dirty work.
Yeah.
But because she was a bloodthirsty cannibal tyrant, she's well equipped to do work for the Federation.
Yeah, so, you know. It's Operation Paperclip, but it's literally just Hitler.
Yeah.
Yeah. What the fuck are we doing? Anyway.
But it's Hitler, but Hitler still gets to murder all of the people he wants for racist reasons and eat them.
Yeah, she doesn't really do that as much now.
She eats an eyeball at the beginning of this movie.
That could have been a replicated eyeball.
Look, she ate a human eyeball at the beginning, and it's kind of implied that she does this frequently. So she's moved on to this big floating space casino, essentially. It's a nightclub of some kind.
Yeah, she's Andy Garcia in Ocean's 11 at this point.
She just runs this kind of space nightclub outside of Federation space.
Mm-hmm.
And Section 31 has caught up with her because she was hiding out. She was living underneath an alias.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, hey, we need your help with something. It turns out somebody has a Nintendo GameCube, which it looks like a Nintendo GameCube. It even has a little handle on it. And it's like the Solibanite bomb from Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Destroy whole galaxies.
Yeah, you push a button on it and it destroys literally everything in the whole universe.
Yeah, you know, the good idea it is to make one of those.
And evidently she had like a whole collection of these things. And... And why did she build them? Just in case. They don't really say why.
It was basically Doctor Strangelove. It was basically like, if you can't kill me, because if you kill me, everything will blow up.
Yeah.
It was her like attempt to like, you know, tamp down a coup. But basically,
I would have loved to know, like, Star Trek usually at least like tries to wrap some kind of technobabble around its fantastical technologies. This one is just...
It blows some shit out.
They describe it as a super weapon. Again, that's a screenwriting term. Anyway, she's approached by Section 31, this one very, vague personality free character, mm-hmm. Played by Omari Hardwick. The character is named A-Lock.
Yeah.
Says, hey, we're here to recruit you, and
I'm a badass with the past.
I'm a badass with the past, and I have grumble grumble something. And she says, I knew you were here because I recognized some quirks of some people downstairs in my club,
mm-hmm.
that clearly shows that they're with you. And
it's Mission Impossible when Tom Cruise says there was a second IMF team.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with the glasses, 10 o'clock.
We have the Sam Richard character. His name is Quasi. He's a cameloid, mm-hmm. which is the same species as Iman's character from Star Trek VI.
So he's a shapeshifter.
He's a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
We have Zeff, who is actually a microscopic superintelligent organism piloting a very a Vulcan-looking android suit.
Yeah, but unlike Vulcans who try to,
live by a code of logic,
yeah,
he looks like a Vulcan.
And he's highly emotional and very theatrical, which is kind of funny in premise.
Yeah. Well, that's played by an actor named Robert Kaczynski.
Yeah. There's a Delton, which we haven't seen, I think, since Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Yeah, maybe not. And Deltons are said to be very sexually alluring to just about everybody.
Yeah. Persis Kambada played her in Star Trek The Motion Picture, and they're hairless human, basically. Mm. But everyone, if you round a Delton, you're like, I would like to have sex with them. And I find that distracting. And that's basically their whole thing.
Yeah. That character is named Mel, M-E-L-L-E.
Okay.
Fuzz?
Yeah, Fuzz. Wait, I thought Fuzz...
Oh, no, wait, Fuzz is the guy in the suit.
Fuzz is the guy in the suit. There's the mech guy.
Zeff is the guy, the mech
Zeff,
guy.
Zeff is the mech guy.
Robert Kaczynski is mech. He's the mech guy.
Yeah.
Who just has, like, a lot of robotic stuff sticking out of
basically,
his body.
Basically, he's in power armor the whole time, and he's a big, tough guy. He's not very smart.
Sorry, Fuzz is the microscopic organism, and he's played by an actor named Sven Roygrok. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong.
But the big connection to previous Trek is the final member of the crew.
Is Rachel Garrett.
Yeah.
Who was in the episode Yesterday's Enterprise of Next Generation.
Yeah, which is one of the best episodes of Next Generation.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is saying something.
So we got to meet this character, Rachel Garrett, in Next Generation, mm-hmm. when she was already a captain of the Enterprise-C.
And did arguably the most heroic thing anyone's ever done in Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
And now
she's played by an actress named Casey Rohl. Mm-hmm. She's a lot younger. She's like 30 in this version.
You might remember her from Hannibal.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know
Casey Rohl. I think she's a really talented actor. So I was excited. So you're like, oh, Casey Rohl, that's fun.
Anyway, they get a message from Control, who is Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah. We don't find that out till later, but yeah.
No, she gets a voiceover. It's Jamie
Lee Curtis. Well, I'm just saying, if you don't recognize her voice, you might go, oh, I don't know. Jamie Lee Curtis.
Pretty recognizable. Yeah, it's Jamie Lee Curtis. She does appear on camera. Yeah. Well, she appears in, like, as a hologram. And I get the sense that maybe she, like, filmed at her house.
That's very... We could get Jamie Lee Curtis, but we could get her for 10 minutes.
Yeah, like, they sent a makeup person over, like, put her in the Star Trek makeup, and they, like, filmed her against a blue screen.
Yeah, I'm sorry, listen, I'm really busy with Borderlands right now. I just... That's taking up all my time and energy.
Oh, no, it's okay. This is just like Borderlands.
Oh, shit, it actually kind of is.
Yeah.
It's got a vibe.
It's got that Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
This idea of, like, morally dubious... humorous in quotes, mm-hmm. Characters who are kind of irreverent, don't take their mission too seriously, and kind of grow together and learn to work as a team by the end of the movie.
Yeah. Oh my God,
it's kind of a cliche.
How will these people learn to work together in order to save the galaxy?
It's a really old premise. I compared this to the 1986 film Eliminators, if you remember that movie.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
That movie kicks ass. And it has Denise Crosby in it, too. Yeah, so that's fun.
The thing with it also has a mandroid, a ninja, an Indiana Jones type, and they all
and an R2-D2.
That's right.
And a Denise Crosby.
And Denise Crosby, and they all team up to stop an evil time traveler.
Yeah. That movie kicks ass.
It was made for like $1 million. It was a super cheap movie. But they did a lot with their budget, and it has that kind of. A kind of B-movie earnestness that makes it really enjoyable.
Yeah, it's from the same guys who also wrote Arena, which was basically Deep Space Nine, with some of the cast of Deep Space Nine, but if it was like
three or four of the Deep Space Nine cast.
But if it was like a space boxing movie, and that movie kicks ass, and they also co-created the live-action TV series of The Flash.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah,
oh,
same guys. So, like,
I like that TV series
They
of
had
the Flash,
a good pulp vibe. They knew what they were doing,
There's no pulp vibe to Section 31. It feels really derivative, and not of Star Trek. Mm. It feels derivative of stuff like Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
And the David Ayer version of Suicide Squad, where everything's like really hastily introduced. The characters aren't really given a lot of room to breathe or present a lot of personality. And when they do their like quips, their like irreverent, flippant attitude in the face of danger, it's not funny. It doesn't really come across as like effervescent or enjoyable.
I feel like a lot of the humor in this kind of movie, whether it's done well or not, is basically the idea of the joke. Every quip tends to be some sort of elaborate variation of "that just happened."
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah, it's... It always just feels like filler, like we'll write a joke later and then we never got around to it.
There's a bit where Empress Georgiou reveals that her little GameCube was nicknamed Godsend.
Yeah.
It's just that was her code name for it.
Yeah.
And one character is a little baffled if it's supposed to be pronounced Godsend or God's End.
Like, and Godsend, one word, or Godsend, two words with an apostrophe.
They devote 7 or 8 lines of dialogue to this confusion, and it's not the least bit funny. That's the level.
But it's important later.
Is it?
No.
No. It's not a setup for anything.
It's just stuff that happens,
And that's this movie. It's just stuff that happens.
Yeah.
The action is really kind of blandly filmed. There's a bit where two fighters activate some sort of like cloaking mechanism.
Well, it's an intangibility mechanism.
Yeah, where they can run through walls, but when they both have it active, they can touch each other.
Yeah.
So they can fight, and they're like sort of fighting through other people's bodies.
Right. Which is a neat idea, especially for a kung fu sequence when you got Michelle Yeoh involved. And if you look at like Valerian and City of a Thousand Planets, they have a whole sequence which is a chase scene taking place in 2 dimensions simultaneously that overlap with each other.
It's so clever.
But you have to like figure out the logistics of that and also come up with all the fun gags.
Right.
Not every movie does that.
Yeah, Valerian is in one dimension, but his hand is stuck in this device that puts it in the other dimension.
Yeah.
So he has to figure out ways to sort of navigate both spaces, even though he can't see one of them.
Yeah.
But his partner can. And yeah, it's really clever the way they do it in Valerian.
Yeah.
There's no wit to that fight. Mm. It's just kind of an interesting way to add a little bit of an effect to a kung fu sequence.
Right.
And there's going to be a twist as to who was behind it and who wants this Doomsday device. And there's a space hole that they want to escape through back to the Mirror Universe.
Yeah. Which would be bad. Apparently.
I guess so.
That would be bad. We don't want
to
do that.
I'll go back to what I asked before. What does Alex Kurtzman, who didn't write this but was a producer on it, it was directed by one of the Discovery regular directors. His name is Olatunde Osunsanmi.
Yeah. But it's guy, Alex Kirkman's guiding the whole,
yeah, he's know, kind of guiding,
whole enterprise, and, free of the pun. Yeah.
I think he thinks or wants Star Trek to be an action franchise. He thinks it's about the battles.
Right.
Now, Star Trek ships aren't like Star Wars ships. They don't zip around and fly into...
They're not fighter jets.
Yeah, yeah. Until you get to Picard. But, yeah. Well, yeah, that's another issue.
If that's what you're thinking, if you're thinking of Battlestar Galactica, that's what Battlestar Galactica does.
Yeah. There aren't a lot of dogfights in Star Trek.
Well, and they didn't used to be.
And in fact, if you think about...
It was a lot more of
I guess so. But if you think back to Star Trek II, if you think back to Wrath of Khan, it wasn't about two ships zipping around shooting each other and like hitting each other 50 times each.
No, it was a master commander naval battle.
Yeah, they were very slow moving. They could barely see each other. Each hit changed the course of the battle. And it was just like one strike.
All strategic, yeah.
You know, trying to see each other through static, like that kind of stuff.
It was about suspense, not excitement.
And I think that's way more exciting than a bunch of ships flying around at a swarm and a bunch of explosions.
You reach a point when you're creating that kind of visual chaos where it literally is just stuff happening.
It's like just visual noise.
Like you watch like the opening space battle in Star Wars Episode 3, where like the Clone Wars are about to end. Like the last movie ended with "begun the Clone Wars have." The next movie begins with "over the Clone Wars are," and it's like, well, why did? Okay, I guess we'll do a whole series someday. But yeah, it's just You can't tell who's doing what. You can't tell what's important. You can't tell why anything is happening. But you can tell stuff is happening.
No.
That feels like a waste. Feels like we could have conveyed something and, like, made it clear what was happening and what we should care about. And sometimes filmmakers forget to do that.
Like in Section 31.
You don't seem to like this movie very much.
No, I really don't. Yeah. This is the least Star Trek that Star Trek has ever been. You said it's very pliable. This is as far away from the core principles of Star Trek.
I don't know.
You could change the name, like the names of their species,
yeah,
and have a... You would have the exact same kind of straight-to-TV, action-based, sci-fi original TV movie that people would tune into Star Trek to get away from in the 1990s.
Here's what I'm gonna fight you on that. This is an observation. Again, no qualitative statements. Star Trek has been not Star Trek before. I think Star Trek people try to force Star Trek to be something that it's not every so often, I would argue.
Well, a lot of people argue the Kelvinverse.
I would argue that the tone that this movie strikes, whether you like it or not, has way more in common with Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yes.
Than any other movie except maybe Nemesis. These are not the particularly beloved movies in the franchise, by the way, because they are outliers. They do have a very, very different vibe.
Yeah.
So, again, you run into this thing where a franchise goes on long, especially when it has, as Star Trek does, over 900 episodes, and that's not counting books and comics and things.
Right.
Everyone tries their hand at it. Everyone tries to have fun with it. And throughout the decades, there are episodes of Star Trek Next Generation which are clearly trying to, like, evoke X-Files.
Yeah,
because it was hot right now.
There's an alien abduction episode, which is weird.
It was
an alien show. Yeah.
There's an episode of the original series where, like, one of the guest stars was like this famous lawyer nobody remembers anymore.
Melvin Bella. Yeah.
Yeah. These are very specific, timely signifiers that then get lost. But every single one of those could have been someone's introduction to Star Trek, and every single person's introduction to Star Trek often sort of colors what they think it is. It's like your first doctor. Like when you're watching Doctor Who.
Uh-huh.
Like if your first doctor is David Tennant, you think that's what Doctor Who is. Right. If your first doctor is Shinigawa, you might think it's something else. You know,
you can tell when the makers of newer Star Trek, like what kind of Star Trek they were raised on.
Yeah.
I can tell that like Terry Metalis, who oversaw a lot of Picard, you can tell he was fond of the Next Generation movies more than he was of the show. Because he tried to make his seasons more like Star Trek movies.
And he seemed to incorporate a lot more elements of the movies dramatically.
He even reused a lot of like music cues from specifically from the movies in his new season.
Yeah, the second season of Picard is basically, hey, what if Borg Queen but The Voyage Home?
Yeah, but Borg Queen loose on Earth in the present day is the...
And we're going to redo a lot of the gags from A Voyage Home.
Yeah.
I get it. That's good. How many episodes were we doing with that? Oh no. That was a done in one, maybe a two-parter. Oh no. Oh man.
I find it curious that in the second season of Picard they went to an evil universe, kind of like the Mirror Universe, where they're gonna execute the last Borg, and they're like, oh no, we can't commit genocide on the Borg.
Yeah.
That's morally wrong. We have to rescue the Borg and actually go back in time and prevent Earth from becoming genocidal.
Uh-huh.
And then they genocide the Borg in the next season. And it's like, woohoo, yay, blow them up. It's like, it's seen as this heroic thing.
Consistency is rough lately in Star Trek.
Yeah, well, Section 31 is sort of like, it's like the last few kicks of this glory period in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Because they launched CBS All Access, and then they started and to get people in, you know, Star Trek was the bigger lure. It was like the valuable property.
It's what they had that no one else had.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, you want to come in, you want to do Star Trek? Fine. There was a brief period where there were six Star Trek shows running simultaneously.
I mean, not they were all in production somewhere. They weren't like airing new episodes at the same time.
Not on like the same day, that's but yeah, they were airing in rapid
succession.
Like
Lower Decks would end, and then we'd have a new season of Discovery, and then we'd have a new season of Picard.
Yeah, like they were just going and going and going, and there was all of these shows that were still on the air, all in production, all at the same time. There was Discovery, there was Picard, there was Lower Decks, there was Strange New Worlds, there was Prodigy, and there was Short Treks, if you want to count that.
Yeah. And arguably Section 31, since they were trying to get it made.
Yeah, they were trying to get Section 31 made. As of this recording, now that Section 31 has aired, only Strange New Worlds is in production, and they're starting pre-production on a Starfleet Academy show. There's going to
be also a spin-off of Discovery.
And there's about to be two. Kurtzman clearly likes Discovery. He likes the violence and the overwrought emotions of Discovery. Discovery is kind of notorious for not earning its emotional catharses. There's a few moments where characters will say, "I'm so glad we're a family," and I can only think, when did that happen? There's no bottle episodes where characters kind of get to know each other as friends.
I would argue that that's a slight exaggeration, because I think there are definitely beats that do work, but it's for like the three characters that get the most screen time. Well, there's a lot of like smaller characters.
Michael Burnham, Saru, and maybe the Stamets, I guess.
I think Stamets is the other one. Yeah, but like, there's a lot of like there was this one episode in like the final season of Discovery where like the younger character, she's an ensign. They're an ensign. Sorry, they use they them pronouns in the show as well.
Oh, you mean Blue?
Blue
or not Blue?
No, they're not Blue.
Well, there's a character named Blue and a character named Gray, and I mix them up all the time.
I think it's Gray.
Gray Tall.
And Gray is just
non-binary character.
And then there was that one pilot who's got like the cybernetic implant, and I forget her name as well. But she was like, "Oh yeah, no, I've always looked up to her, and we're gonna have this big moment at the end of the episode." And I'm like,
"Who is that character
you introduced?"
Again?
I knew the character. You never talked to her. You never even looked at her.
Yeah,
until this
together.
Episode, and we're supposed to suddenly be really invested in that. They struggled with that, but I would argue that there's a lot of great bits with Saru, and I think there's a lot of great bits with other, Tilly as well. Listen, I have mixed feelings about Discovery. Whitney does not like Discovery.
I do not like Discovery.
All right, but I think there's some good in it.
But I feel like Alex Kurtzman likes the idea of a Star Trek show that is like freewheeling and violent, and doesn't have to address sort of the ideas of Star Trek that depict it as a world where there isn't war and violence, where there isn't some kind of violent conflict that can be solved with weapons.
Look,
he's not very fond of, like, it wasn't until like maybe the like halfway through the third season that there was even an episode where they talked about diplomacy.
It's a slight exaggeration, but I will say this. I feel like we talk about this a lot on our other Star Trek podcast, and we should move on soon. When Roddenberry created The Next Generation, his idea of a utopian future was more solidified than it was in the original series.
Yeah, because he actually came up with a lot of those ideas after Star Trek was off the air.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so the idea was, by the time The Next Generation rolled around, which is like 70 years after the original series, something like that.
About a century, actually.
About a century, okay. But like, the Federation had evolved, humanity had evolved, and we'd kind of moved past most of the bullshit. Yeah. And he had various tenets. There were certain rules that the show had to follow. And one of the rules that he had was there would be no interpersonal conflict between members of the crew.
They had to get along and solve problems together well.
Yes. Now, that is a great utopian idea. It sounds like a wonderful workplace. And the writer's room had no fucking idea how to do that. That is the antithesis of almost any writing advice you'd get in any book.
They were only used to the only way they could come up with story was to generate drama, and the best way to generate drama was interpersonal conflict.
This is one of the reasons.
It's like one
why
of the basic tenets of like screenwriting. And when Gene Roddenberry says don't do that, they just started tearing their hair.
I actually think that was a bold choice on Roddenberry's part, and I think there is a lot that tenet that all writing, all drama must have conflict between the characters.
It can feel really contrived.
Well, it can feel really contrived, and I think there are negative consequences to that. Think about every sitcom you've ever seen between people who are married, and it seems like they fucking hate each other.
Yeah.
Like, they're constantly bickering, they're rolling their eyes, one of these days, Alice to the moon, like, because, like, oh, these are our main characters, they have to have conflicts. They're married. Does no one have a positive marriage in a sitcom? I know there are a few exceptions, but it's rare, is my point.
The best couple on in classic TV.
Mm-hmm.
is Gomez and Morticia Adams.
Yes, they really into each other, and that fuels the story. You can do that. They're a unit. Mm. They're not divided. They're together, and they're solving problems together in a very Adams Family way, and the crew of the Enterprise solved their problems in a very Star Trek-y way. My point is this. There were always writers who bristled at that, and after Roddenberry passed away, they started like sort of, you know, kind of pulling at that a little bit, you know, fudging that rule, but still kind of mostly held. And I feel like something like Section 31 and some of the other stuff that's come out lately is basically like, fuck that. And that's why some of it doesn't feel very Star Trek-y.
Doesn't feel very...
Because it's just any movie now.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like Star Trek. There's no notion that there's even, like, a Federation out there, or that there's a Starfleet in operation.
Well, one character says they're in Starfleet multiple times.
Rachel Garrett says she's in Starfleet, and she says, I'm here to make sure you don't kill anybody, but she doesn't wear a uniform.
Yeah.
She doesn't say, you know...
Well, she's undercover.
I suppose so, but... I mean, okay,
wear a uniform,
don't make her Rachel Garrett. Don't mention Starfleet.
Yeah.
The story wouldn't change at all.
But then it wouldn't have Rachel Garrett.
Fine.
Yeah. I will say this. I'm gonna
call her, you know, Jennifer McGillicuddy, and it's going to have the same effect. Just say, I'm from the Alliance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a lot of Federation-like concepts throughout a lot of mm-hmm. science fiction since Star Trek.
Yeah.
Just have it be a bit of a knockoff, and boom, you just have a Sci-Fi Channel original movie.
Yeah.
A failed pilot that was turned into a TV movie.
Yeah. Happens all the time, or used to.
And yeah, it doesn't have to be Star Trek for any of that to function.
Yeah.
Nothing needs to be Star Trek in this for it to function. And yeah. It doesn't have any of the concepts about Star Trek that make it Star Trek. Yeah. It's all about interpersonal conflict. It's all about fighting for a means. It's all about blowing up a bad guy.
And again, setting aside that it's not like Star Trek, which some people is a plus. Not everyone's into Star Trek.
Hmm.
You're also arguing that it's just not very good.
If it had good, charming characters.
Yeah.
Like, look at something like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
That, of course, I think was sort of bolstered by its connection to, like, the Marvel universe.
Of course, yeah.
People wouldn't have seen that if it was original characters.
Probably not. No, yeah, that's a
but because, it,
bet.
Yeah, yeah. I think people flocked to it and they realized sort of how kind of lightweight and charming it was, these kind of weird ragtag characters.
Yeah.
Because they were sort of given the connection to Marvel.
And they were distinctly drawn as well.
Yeah, but I was going to say, I think an advantage something like Guardians of the Galaxy have, and yeah. I like that movie okay.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan like some people, but...
I think that first one's really great, yeah.
But I feel like each character was uniquely drawn. It was given... Each character was given a little bit of personality and a little bit of backstory throughout the film, so we knew, like, a little bit about them. We got to know how those characters interacted with one another, that they were a little bit antagonistic, but realized that they had a bigger thing that they had to fight for. Mm. There was a little bit of heart to that movie, a little bit of emotional connection. I've heard that some people say they even cry during that film.
There's a few moments where, like, a character, a beloved character dies, you know, and it means something.
Mm, like, you know? They die for, like, a purpose.
Yeah, and they say something very, very sweet, and it's like, man.
It is about a doomsday weapon. It is about a generic villain who wants a doomsday weapon. The plot is not interesting.
No.
But the characters have enough charm, and the dialogue has enough wit that a lot of people are drawn to something like that.
Sure.
Okay, we have the same generic story in Section 31, but there is no charm, and there is no wit, and there's no cleverness to it. Mm. The filmmaking is very flat and bland. The settings are all very generic. The characters are kind of generic.
Yeah.
I like the idea of a microscopic organism piloting a man suit, but
that's a neat idea.
It's a neat idea, but they don't do enough with it.
I do think that at the very least, they do take pains to make sure the characters are distinguishable from one another.
Yeah.
Whether or not they're well fleshed out is a matter of debate. They're broad, but they do look different from each other. Here's the mech guy. Here's the microorganism who's in a Vulcan, but he's very emotional, and isn't that a sort of sexy
Delton, charming shapeshifter, straight-laced bureaucrat.
Space cannibal Hitler.
Space cannibal Hitler is our leader.
Yeah. I don't like that sentence that you just said. I don't like that sentence at all. I don't like that that's out there in the ether.
And it's Star Trek, for God's sake. Imagine if Emperor Palpatine joined a ragtag band of misfits.
Oh, some people would love that. Some people, that's everything they've ever wanted. Oh, see, Palpatine's not so bad. Because now what happens when you make the villain a protagonist. Yeah. Is you have to come up with some kind of like rooting interest. She's, and now all of a sudden, Venom is a hero.
Yeah.
You know?
She's a fun villain character. Anyway, we've spent a long time on Star Trek because we had a lot to say.
Last little thing. Because I know some people are listening to this who do listen to all yesterday's Star Trek podcast. There is one bit, like one sort of thing at the end of this movie that would have clearly been the next episode or the next season. It's like the story will continue. And it's basically a pitch I've been making on all our yesterdays for a long ass time. Like, I really wish they would do this, or they would make this movie or make this show. And it's at the end of this. And I'm like, oh, but you're not going to do anymore. That's what I wanted. I want that bit. That's the cool bit. Why didn't we start there? Damn it. No one ever get it. Anyway, that's all I'll say. Let's move on. The other big movie that we saw, that we both saw this week, and I can actually talk about whether I like this one, is an animated movie called Dogman, which is not related to Wolfman.
No.
Which is a little confusing.
Both
came out in January. I don't know why we needed to do that.
Dogman is an adjunct of Captain Underpants by author Daph Pilkey, or I guess it's Dave Pilkey.
Did Dogman meet Captain Underpants?
Well, the main characters from Captain Underpants, George Beard and Harold Hutchins, they draw comics. That's what they do in their spare time. And they draw comics starring Captain Underpants, but they also live in a world where they've created Captain Underpants based on their own comics. And at the end of the final Captain Underpants book, they say, I don't want to do another Captain Underpants story. Let's do a Dogman comic. And the Dogman books are ostensibly the comics written and drawn by George and Harold.
Okay, so this movie is the story that the characters from the Captain Underpants movie wrote and made for.
Exactly, okay. And that explains why the aesthetic of the Dogman movie is looks like children's drawings. Like the cops are spelled COPZ on like their everything looks like they're made of crayons. Handmade, everything's kind of scribbled in. Even the characters have kind of a drawing look to them, like big thick lines and simple facial expressions.
It's the same creative conceit that follows the Lego movies, because you watch a Lego movie and it's like, oh yeah, it's pretty much all from the perspective of this kid who's playing with his Legos. And then you watch the Lego Batman movie and it's still that same kid.
Yeah.
Because everything is consistent. I interviewed like the filmmakers and they're like, yeah, no, it's from the same kid.
Yeah.
All those movies are played by the same boy.
And a lot of the story and the pacing of Dogman is really frantic and it just kind of goes to weird places. It has like a little kid sense of humor because it's you can tell it's being created by kids.
By kids, for kids.
Yeah.
No, they're not trying to like write more mature than their years.
No.
Yeah. The premise of Dogman is that there is a big metropolitan city. And there are two hero cops at the beginning of it. There's a dude cop and his partner who's a dog.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the movie, they're fighting. What's the name of the cat again?
Petey.
Petey, the most evil cat in the world. He's their Lex Luthor nemesis. Always doing evil things. They're in a car chase with them, and it all leads to they're at the top of an abandoned warehouse building, and there's a bomb. And they have to defuse the bomb. And they... Boy, do they screw that up. And when they get to the hospital...
The cop's head is damaged beyond repair.
Yeah, and so is the dog's body.
The body is damaged beyond repair.
Which is actually kind of morbid as a start to a kid's story, because what they say is, listen, your head is useless and your body is useless, so we're going to sew the dog's head onto the guy's body. So the guy did die. This is just the dog.
It's the dog's brain.
It's very
it's almost
RoboCop.
Like poor things in a way. But
It's RoboCop. It's what it is. There's even the bit in RoboCop, the first RoboCop, where he like goes back to his house and like his family has moved out and he's having all his memories. They do that in Dogman. Like it's so those kids in Captain Underpants who should not be watching RoboCop at their age. That's an incredibly violent movie.
Like something about RoboCop, like it leaked down to the kids who created it. It's like, I'll just sew a dog onto a
Look,
man's
we saw
body,
the Joel Kinnaman movie, so we got the gist.
The Joel Kinnaman
movie. No! No wonder it's all messed up.
So in order to understand Dogman, you have to see the Joel Kinnaman version of RoboCop.
Sorry. that's not recommended.
Dogman is better than the Joel Kinnaman version of RoboCop.
That's true. It's also better than RoboCop 3.
Arguable.
3
3 has...
With Rip Torn, the robot ninja, and, like, it takes 30 minutes for RoboCop to show up in a 90-minute movie.
It's got the jetpack and the robot ninja. It's like...
It's the most disinterested Nancy Allen has ever been in anything in her life.
It has a schlock. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember liking how schlocky it was.
It does not work.
Okay, I'll have to rewatch
I'll defend RoboCop 2 to the end.
Oh, RoboCop 2 is fantastic.
RoboCop 2 is very fun. RoboCop 3 is... such crap. Right. They're trying to make it for kids, basically.
But if you read the original Dogman books, which I have because I have a child.
Yeah, this is all alien to me. I don't know this.
There's actually this weird, very emotionally disarming elements to the Dogman books because they start to take on some pretty serious issues. The cat Petey clones himself and has Lil Petey, who is his.
Is mini-me, basically.
A mini-me is like, I need a partner who thinks exactly like me, but he clones himself and gets a child out of it.
Yeah, it's not like an exact copy of himself now.
And so at first he's like, oh no, what do I do with this clone that's a young child? As it turns out, Lil Petey doesn't have the same propensity for wickedness. In fact, he's quite the opposite.
Well, he hasn't gone through the hardship that Petey went through that made him like cynical
A big part of this movie and a big part of the Dogman books is exploring why Petey became evil and actually the hardships he did go through and how he came to lose hope in humanity and how having a child is forcing him to reckon with his own cynicism.
Right.
And how he doesn't... Even though he is still cynical, he doesn't necessarily want to pass that on to his own son.
Yeah.
There's a robot they build called AD...
ADHD.
AD...
I think it's ADHD.
The number 80. ADHD.
Okay.
But
so
it's meant to sound like ADHD, which Dav Pilkey has been diagnosed.
Sure.
So we're trying to get into sort of the reason why people behave the way they do. And the relationships they have and how the kind of mark they're trying to leave on the world and how it's going to be ultimately very positive and very peaceful. So there's a lot of like complex emotions going on in the Dogman books.
I was surprised, I think
the whole second half of this movie until it turns into like action mayhem.
It gets madcap at the end.
Or there's a giving life spray.
Yeah.
And there's an evil fish, evil psychic fish that brings buildings to life. And all of that's pretty fun. I liked the living buildings.
Yeah, the living buildings are there's this one joke is a lot of buildings come to life and start walking around, and
it's like kaiju, and they got the big eyes,
and it cuts to like some people like in the park say, "Hey, I can see my house from here," and the house like waves at them.
Yeah,
like that's
a cute joke.
That's good, clean fun. We can all enjoy that joke. I did not need Ricky Gervais in this movie.
He plays the voice of the psychic.
Yeah, I didn't need that. And when Ricky Gervais is making a point about how like, oh, actually we all need to like love each other and not be mean, and I'm like, really, Ricky?
His whole comedy bit is predicated on being mean, and then he's also mean in real life.
Well, so. and he's also said some really terrible things about trans people and people like him and Dave Chappelle and sort of normalizing that discourse is not an insignificant part of why we are here now.
Yeah.
And so I'm still mad at him for that. So that's a bit of a black mark. I will say I love the Captain Underpants movie.
Yeah.
I think that's a brilliant movie. I don't know the books. I think it's a wonderful movie. It's beautifully animated. It's got a funny story.
It's
an ode to an imagination.
Yeah.
I think it's the closest we'll ever get to a Calvin and the Hobbes film.
Yeah. Well, and you could say that about... I'm sure Dav Pilkey read Calvin and Hobbes.
Petey looks like Hobbes.
Yeah.
He looks like Hobbes. That feels like that's probably at least somewhat intentional. I'm less high on Dogman.
Well, Dogman is clearly courting a bit of a younger audience.
Well, yeah, but
and
that's...
Captain Underpants celebrates a certain kind of potty humor and understands the way certain kids have friendships and the way they can be on each other's wavelength.
Yeah.
And also it has things we can really relate to. Going to school, for instance, or having a mean principal, or, you know, your interest drawing comics because it's about the kids.
Yeah.
Dogman is about a man with a dog for a head, or a dog with a man for a body.
Who's a cop.
Who's also a cop.
Yeah, it's a propaganda movie, so it's also, some people are going to be like, I know some people who are like, I don't want to see a kid's propaganda movie. And I'm like, I actually get it. I do. This is pretty harmless as far as that goes, but it can only be so harmless.
This one's a little bit more frantic. It's about animal people. Well, they're trying to lay down a lot of mythology very quickly. This movie's like 80 minutes.
It's very brisk. I was actually surprised. It's interesting that you called it frantic, I think, twice now.
Yeah.
I actually thought it kind of lost steam a bit in the middle.
When it starts focusing on Petey and Lil Petey.
Yeah, which is fine, by the way, but it just, like, everything, it started off at kind of a madcap pace.
There's a lot of screaming.
Yeah, and then it just kind of, I'm not saying it's bad, but pacing-wise, it really does sag at that point. There's nothing really pushing it forward for a while. We're kind of ahead of it. There's a bit of a mistaken identity thing where Dogman meets Lil Petey and doesn't make the connection.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a whole thing. But, like, yeah, the movie, the story kind of stops for that, and I feel like it might have been, I think it might have been more effective in terms of just pacing to keep a little of that energy going in the middle, because it really does feel kind of sapped, like it kind of had a sugar crash, and then it has another Snickers right at the end, and it's like, oh right, living buildings, ha! Like, which is not the end of the world. But I did find my interest waning a bit, even though emotionally I was more involved in the middle. But I was just, I was laughing less. I was a little less, you know, entertained.
Okay.
I was just sort of, it worked, but I think it was not as carefully modulated as the Captain Underpants movie in terms of balancing all of its factors throughout the entire movie. It felt like sometimes it just gave, okay, well, all the fun Dogman stuff, we're not going to do that for 30 minutes. And then we're just going to do this, and this is fine too. But if you like that stuff, you might get a little bored in the middle here.
What I appreciate about that kind of structure, that kind of the way this movie is paced, is it did remind, maybe this is just a personal thing, because I also wrote stories and drew comics when I was a kid. How sometimes you get so involved with the story that you actually lose sight of the action that drew you into the story to begin with. I'm going to do this funny thing about a man with a dog head.
Yeah.
And he's a cop.
It feels very Axe Cop in a way. Like,
yeah, but I'm kind of making this up, but then you realize, wait a minute, I'm going to start getting into the detail about the side character. And then all of a sudden you realize you wrote 30 pages about the side character and you completely forgot the original premise of it.
So it's Tristram Shandy for kids.
Yeah, it has. Okay. Well, I mean, I think that's the way kids think, is a little bit more Tristram Shandy-ish.
Yeah.
Kids love that book. Little Lawrence Stearns at heart.
Kids love that book. If you bring up Tristram Shandy, they're just like, oh, Tristram Shandy. I love the Tristram Shandy.
I've read Tristram Shandy. I know you have that book.
Yeah, when you were 5, you loved it. It was your favorite thing.
25, but yeah.
Okay, so there were 20 of you, and when you were 5, we're done.
I recommend Tristram Shandy. It's very
good. I know you do. And I like Dogman. I don't love Dogman, but I like Dogman. It's very sweet. It had some good jokes in it.
I agree with you that it doesn't have the solid foundation of something like Captain Underpants.
Yeah, but it does have, and this is,
but it has heart.
That's the thing. Yeah. It sounds kind of corny to say, like, it's got a lot of heart.
But it does.
Yeah. It's a very tender and sincere story about relationships and loneliness and the types of experiences that make us who we are and the types of experience that are capable of changing us. And they're not always easy, and they sometimes involve a lot of backsliding.
Yeah.
And I think the movie is surprisingly mature and empathetic about stuff like that. And ultimately, I think even though, you know, the funny, silly, you know, nonsense is more objectively, not objectively, that's a terrible word to use in criticism, but it is more superficially entertaining, like on the surface. I got the part that I'm going to stick, that's going to stick with me, is the emotional journey of Petey and Lil Petey. That's what's going to connect. But I wasn't as entertained as I was by the comedy. Yeah. So it's just the balancing act wasn't perfect, but it's really cute. Okay, we got 3 more movies here. I saw 2 and you saw 1.
Tell me about the one you saw.
Okay, well, I'm going to start with Companion, and we do a thing here. And I don't know how many people care about this, but every time I've, like, not done it, someone has said, please bring it back.
Okay.
But when we put our descriptions of the movie, of the podcast, sorry, in the feed, we include time codes for each review. This gets kind of knocked akimbo a little bit, because on the main feed, we have commercials, and that can kind of, like, push things off the time code a little bit, but it's... Mm. You know, close, and it's close. Like, you might be a minute off by this point. In the episode, if you're listening on the main feed and not on Patreon, where you can listen for free free commercials. So I'm going to tell you this right now. Companion, it's a new horror comedy, is the kind of movie that I'm very glad I saw without seeing any of the marketing.
Okay.
Because it's one of those movies where it's like kind of like Abigail. The marketing gives away something that's probably supposed to be revealed around like minute 35.
Uh-huh.
And the whole first act is better if you don't know it.
Yeah.
At least the first time. And I think that I find that deeply annoying. I've talked about it a lot. I call it red eye syndrome, where it's just you put a twist too early in the movie and you can't market it without ruining that twist. And so the movie's, the audience is ahead of your movie, and it's an unfortunate thing, but it happens sometimes. So if you don't know anything about Companion, you can go right on ahead and skip to the next review. Okay. I would like to save this for you because I had a delightful time discovering this movie as it unfolded. I think it is just wickedly funny, very clever, does a few things, familiar things in an unfamiliar way, raises some interesting questions. It's really, really good. And if you've already seen the trailer and you know what's up, you can stick around. But I'm not going to hold back on what should be a spoiler because they've already ruined it. But if you don't want to be spoiled, skip ahead. Okay, we're good. Give you a moment. And we're fine. Companion is a story. It stars Jack Quaid from Star Trek Lower Decks. You can applaud.
And many other things as well.
Yeah, he's in a few other things.
He's going through a rather prolific phase.
Yeah, he's Superman right now. on my Adventures with Superman, which is a really good show. He's got another like action comedy coming out like next month called Novocaine. He was in Scream, like the reboot Scream.
The Scream 5.
Scream, technically Scream 5, but they called it Scream. He's really, really talented. I think he's really, really great. He's Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan's son, and he looks it. It looks like they put those two in a blender.
We don't have to, be coy about that fact. Yeah, it's pretty clear.
It's very, very clear. He looks like if you combined... If you told a machine, could you combine Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan, you would get Jack Quaid. It's kind of perfect. Anyway, he plays the boyfriend of a girl played by Sophie Thatcher. Sophie Thatcher is, obviously she's very beautiful, but she's also very devoted to her boyfriend. She loves her boyfriend very, very much. And they're off on a trip to visit some friends who are hanging out at kind of an isolated estate that one of their rich boyfriends owns.
Okay.
Out in the middle of nowhere in the woods, where it's one of those. And throughout the first act, we're meeting these two characters, we're getting to know them better. We're seeing Jack Quaid has a friend, possibly an ex, who Sophie Thatcher is very jealous of.
Okay.
There's a gay couple that they're with too, who it's unclear exactly how they're going to fit into the narrative for a while, but they're there. Jack Quaid's friend / possible ex has a boyfriend who is a married Russian millionaire. And we don't know how he got his money, but we do know he got it the dirty way.
Okay.
At some point, something happens, and Sophie Thatcher is put in a position where she has to defend herself. And she...
Like physically?
Physically.
Okay.
And she ends up... I'm just going to take it to the first plot point. She ends up killing the Russian guy.
Oh, God. Okay.
And everyone's like, oh, shit. Oh, my God. What are we going to do? Oh, this wasn't supposed to happen. Oh, man. Oh, man. And then Jack Quaid just says, go to sleep. And then Sophie Thatcher turns off. And she wakes up, and it turns out she's a sex bot.
Okay.
This is a somewhat common piece of technology. People are aware of this. It's not like something only he has. It's a little high end. There's even a joke later on where he's just like, yeah, I don't even own you. I rent you.
Oh, wow. Okay. Like,
he doesn't... So something happened and she broke three of her programming that Isaac Asimov, not supposed to harm a human. Right. And I'm not going to tell you anything more because there's more twists and turns.
Is she conscious?
That's the question, isn't it? Yeah. How conscious is she? And what becomes clear over the course of it is that she is a complicated enough, robot, companion, artificial intelligence or whatever, that at the very least there's a chance there's burgeoning consciousness.
Okay.
She ends up, like, going on the run because she's worried they're going to deactivate her.
Okay.
And
so she is conscious.
She is conscious. Yeah, and then, well, again, there's a question of how much of it is her programming, how much of it is what might have been done to her programming. These are questions the movie asks, and I think answers, but I don't want to give you all the answers. There's some really fun bits where she's able to, like, steal Jack Quaid's remote control.
For her. Okay.
And she's able to, like, give herself new accents and things, and then she looks at, like, the intelligence meter, and he's got it at, like, 40. And she's like, oh, come on. And so she scoots that right up to 100, which is a really clever bit. But, yeah, so it turns out there's intrigue, whatever, and it's all elaborate metaphor for...
men's control of women.
Men's control of women. Yeah. Basically, men's control of women, or basically control of anyone in a romantic situation. There are some parallels with the gay couple as well that, raise questions outside of the gender, the gender aspect of it. But it's definitely about that too. This is from, I think it's produced by the director of Barbarian, another movie which, you know, relied a lot on twists, and just people acting awfully.
Yeah,
that's kind of the meat and potatoes of it.
One of the main characters of that movie is a complete scoundrel.
Yes, an absolutely terrible human being. And we're gonna get some of those in here too. I appreciate the gut punch that Barbarian is.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't think it's a great movie. I find it frustrating. I think there's great bits in it, but I actually think ultimately
it is, like, weirdly structured.
It's weirdly structured, but more than that, it feels like the things that it finds horrifying are kind of off, like, kind of askew from the movie's moral compass. Like, it's basically saying, like, you know who's, like, the worst monster in all of this? This victim. And I'm like, that's weird. And I feel like you're not really engaging with that question. Companion engages with these questions.
Okay.
And I think ultimately emerges, I think it asks more salient questions and actually delves into them more interestingly, while also being really fucking funny.
Okay.
It is really fucking funny. I laugh my ass off at this movie without ever losing the sense of suspense. There really is this sense that, you know, it's one of those movies where one bad thing happens and then everything gets worse and worse and worse and worse. How else can this day go wrong? And as that keeps happening, the noose starts tightening, more bodies start piling up. And there really is a genuine sense of suspense and a genuine wonder of how is anyone getting out of this? Because we're kind of fucked here. Like, this is a bad situation. It's just really cleverly written. Jack Quaid and Sophie Thatcher are really great. Harvey Guillen, from What We Do in the Shadows, is in this as well. He's very funny. Mm. But yeah, no, it's smart, interesting, funny sci-fi. Okay. And I do think it's very, very good.
I'm sorry I missed it. Yeah. I was trying to make it out, but I just didn't get it.
I think it helped that I was genuinely not sure what movie I was watching until the big reveal.
Hmm.
I was clued into what was off. I didn't guess why. Yeah. And I think it's frustrating that while producing this movie, all the posters just say sex bot.
Yeah.
Producer trailers, evil sex bot, or sex bot kills somebody.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're not wrong, but you're not preserving the experience and you're not doing the movie a lot of favors.
Yeah.
So I hope some people get to see it spoiler free, but I think even if you don't, it might be a situation where you're kind of waiting for the movie to get started after the movie has started.
Uh-huh.
But it's still very smart and clever and suspenseful and funny, and I think it's a really good film. I think it's the first great movie I've seen this year.
Oh, that's interesting.
I could be forgetting something, but I think... Because there's definitely some movies I reviewed that were, like, technically last year releases that didn't get theatrically released until now that we didn't cover. Mm. But I think this is the first great movie I've seen this year. So I do recommend it a lot.
Amazing. All okay. Right.
So you've got a new film. It's a horror film from Steven Soderbergh.
That's right. It's one of two films he's going to release this year.
No. Only two this year.
Only two this year, yeah.
Remember when he retired? And then he retired again.
And then he retired again.
He's retired more times than Hayao Miyazaki at this point.
He keeps on saying that he wants to retire. He says he's going to stop making movies. But then projects keep on coming up that he wants to do.
He just thinks movie making is neat, I guess. He can't help himself.
And
we're all the better for him. Most of his movies are really good.
Yeah, it's rare that he's disappointed me.
Yeah.
It's happened a couple times.
Yeah, he's prolific enough that he can't, you know, they're not all going to be, you know, winners. But, like, it's... And he's got a lot of variety in his filmmaking, too, which I appreciate.
Yeah,
like, well, he doesn't make the same. He's made the same movie over and over again a couple of times. He really likes heist movies, but like,
yeah, because he did Ocean's 11, and then he did
and 12 and 13,
and they also did Logan Lucky, which is very similar. It's to working Ocean's class 11,
Ocean's 11, basically, and I actually like it better than.
Yeah, he has a film coming out later this year called Black Bag, with which was written by David Koepp. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Okay.
But yeah, this new film Presence is his take on a haunted house movie. And the gimmick of Presence is that it takes place in the haunted house.
Yeah.
A family moves in. There's a ghost there. And it's told entirely from the perspective of the ghost.
Okay.
But the camera is the ghost. So we get to see everything like through the ghost's eyes, essentially.
Okay. No, is it like monster vision? How do we know it's like from the ghost's perspective besides the fact that it's just there?
The way it... the introductory sequence of the movie is... the camera sort of floating through, like using a Steadicam.
Yeah.
It almost looks like a drone, just sort of floating around this house. And like the family comes in and it floats up close.
So it's like doing so with purpose, like as if like it's.
Yeah, like it's kind of looking at them.
Okay.
And it kind of settles on the teenage daughter of the family that's moving in. The dad is played by Chris Payne. Or no, the character's named Chris Payne. The dad's played by Chris Sullivan.
Ah.
And the mom is played by Lucy Liu, and their teenage daughter is played by Kalina Liang. A character, an actress I'm not terribly familiar with.
Okay.
But she has a bit of a sixth sense. So she's the one who, like, at one point looks directly at the camera.
Mm.
She is also going through something really, really tough. Her best friend just died. She's going through a lot of horrible trauma. And that's sort of making her a little bit more sensitive to the fact that there's a presence in the house.
Mm.
Her older brother is a complete lout. He's a teenager and he's like trying to drain himself of empathy. And he's constantly talking about these really cruel pranks he's playing on people at school. Mm. And the dad is like trying to straighten him out as gently as he possibly can. And the Lucy Liu character is checked out. Like she's just focusing on business and is not interacting with the family that much anymore.
Got it.
And of course, there's a plot that starts to emerge after a while. Some other characters enter the scene. There's one of those, like in the Amityville Horror, there's the bit where they welcome the medium inside and they get to explain a lot of the... a lot of the exposition as to what's really going on, the rules of this universe.
Yeah, someone's got to say it. Yeah.
But Soderbergh is a lot more interesting. He's a lot more naturalistic a filmmaker, even though some of his films are very mannered and stylized.
Yeah.
He tends to shoot his films in such a way that it feels a little bit more handheld and off the cuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think his last horror movie was Unsane, which was actually filmed on like an iPhone. And was it Claire Foy in that one, I think?
Claire Foy.
Yeah, and she was...
He's always been really interested in digital technology, like digital cameras.
Bubble. Long time ago.
Bubble was really interesting because he not only shot it digitally, but it had that weird release schedule. Home video theaters and on streaming all simultaneously.
Right, which was kind of a forerunner to a lot of independent movies do that now. Yeah. You can see it in theaters or you can pay $20 and see it on VOD. Yeah.
And I think he likes the digital aesthetic because it does have a little bit more of a handmade quality to it.
Yeah.
Or at least it did when he started using it, and he kind of sticks with that aesthetic, even though digital cameras are now super sophisticated. What Presence has is that quality, that kind of handmade quality, where he's trying to use the camera itself as a special effect. And it actually has a really interesting viewpoint on the ghost, because when the teenage girl notices there might be a ghost in the room, it realizes it's kind of been seen, and it literally hides in the closet.
Oh, that's cute.
There's a few bits where it tries to interact with people, and it kind of like vibrates. It's like this angry ghost that... If you've ever been one of those people who thinks they have felt a ghost in the room,
right?
It kind of makes sense in that way.
Well, let me ask you a question, because I had an opportunity to see it. I couldn't. Life's been complicated in Los Angeles the last month. I really wanted to because I heard good things. What I'm unclear about from hearing you talk and from hearing some other people talk about this movie, it's obviously a haunted house story.
Yes.
Is it a horror story? Is it scary?
It's a horror story because
it sounds like you could argue that like there's
it could just version, be a family drama.
This could be a version of Casper, you know? Like, that's kind of the plot of Casper, where we're seeing Christina Ricci and Bill Pullman through Casper's eyes for part of it.
I can't tell you the horror elements without giving away some, like, certain plot details.
Okay. But it is a horror movie.
There is a threat. There's some horror. There's a lot of... The characters are all afraid, and there's death sort of hanging over the family. So it has that horror tone to it.
Because you can do ghost stories that are very life-affirming and rousing. The Ghost of Mrs. Muir. Mm. That movie makes me cry like nobody's business. It's so good.
Ghost, for example, is a great one. There's plenty of uplifting or even comedic ghost movies out there.
Or just pensive ones, like Ghost Story.
Yeah.
You know, with the guy, David Lowry.
That's right.
Yeah.
I like a ghost story. I like David Lowery's a ghost story.
Yeah, you like it more than I do, but I get it. But it's a very pensive ghost story. It's technically a ghost story, but it's not really scary. It's just about what it would be like to be a ghost. It would be kind of weird, right?
Time kind of falls away. Your identity kind of falls away after a while. No, this is definitely a horror movie, and it has horror elements to it. But again, I don't want to reveal any of what those things are.
No, it's fine. But it's good.
But it is good, and I think a lot of the character work is really honest. I like movies that try to capture our idea of what death would feel like.
Right.
Over what an afterlife might feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen plenty of movies where characters die and go to some version of heaven, for instance.
Sure.
Or we've seen so many haunting movies, and a lot of ghosts are kind of like just detached, vengeful feelings.
Yeah, they have unresolved from their death. Things.
Yeah, it's always about something being unresolved. And most ghost stories are about domestic strife at the heart of it, after all.
Especially haunted house stories. What is a haunted house?
It's just the evil that's floating around through a domestic scene.
It's a house where stuff happened before you got there.
Yeah,
or there's strife within
the family, and the ghost represents that strife.
Yeah. So it's always
all of that is also in Presence. But I feel like this has a little bit of a novel view of what it would like to be a ghost. Because you, essentially, the viewer, are the ghost. You're floating through. You're seeing it through everybody's eyes.
Okay, now it sounds like a carnival baka. You are the ghost! Yeah.
Another film that did this very well that I'm very fond of was Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void.
I was waiting for that to show up. I was waiting for you to reference that. I knew that's also
a movie about, told from, like, the perspective of, like, within the eyeballs of the main character, but he dies, and we get to see sort of how the main character's spirit sort of drifts off and drifts in and out and starts drifting through time after a while and starts seeing partly the real world but partly the afterlife. I think that's a really interesting movie, an interesting way to view the afterlife. And I feel like Steven Soderbergh is trying to do something similar, but, like, with his own novel edge to it.
Sure.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I would like to point out that after multiple episodes of the show, we've had to record in a different space than we've normally recorded in.
Yeah.
And I've made multiple apologies, and people told me it's not so bad, you can barely hear the refrigerator. This fucker's getting louder. this thing is trying to tick me off. I know, I'm kind of hyper-aware of our sound.
Movie,
I'm never entirely happy with the sound we can get because we don't have, like, a proper studio.
We're reviewing a movie about a ghost. Maybe there's something to that. Maybe the fridge wants to get in on the conversation for some reason.
What have you got, Fridgey?
The fridge is possessed. The fridge is trying to tell us something about its own ghostly...
What have we got here?
It's opening the fridge!
So we've got like a bunch of garlic, because I'm Italian, of course we do. We've got some beef stock that I should really use up soon. I got some butter. I got some LaCroix.
Okay.
Some perfect bars in here.
Drives me nuts that it's not pronounced LaCroix.
I know, right? So I'm not sure what my refrigerator is trying to convey with that. But maybe someone can figure it out, like the kid with the cereal boxes and Lady in the Water.
There's meaning to all of this.
Anyway.
Tell me about another movie.
All right, so last movie we're reviewing this week, it's called Love Me. And I mentioned at the top, it's got a really novel premise. The opening of the movie is the creation of the universe, followed by the creation of Earth, followed by Earth getting hit by, a meteor. And this is all, like, time-lapse photography. So we're seeing billions upon billions of years in just, like, a minute. And we see, like, the Pangea evolve. And then, all of a sudden, everything gets really loud. Like, we hear, like, a lot of radio transmissions and music and all this kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, all of that gets turned off at once. And everything kind of slows down. And now here we are. Humanity has died. And our protagonist, our main character, at least for the first part of the movie, is a scientific flotation buoy. It's just, it's floating in the ocean.
Is
it's supposed
it human shaped
no,
anyway?
No, okay. It is not. No, it is not. It looks like a flotation buoy with like a camera on it. And it's just sort of looking around, and apparently it's been doing this for, it's solar powered, so it can go on for a long time. And it's just doing its thing. And then every once in a while, it sees overhead, like one light in the sky flies across, and that's a satellite. And the boy can pick up on the satellite's transmissions, and the satellite's transmissions are basically, I am this satellite, and I'm here to welcome any visitors who might come to Earth and tell you what Earth was like.
Mm-hmm.
It was like this thing we put up last minute, like in, almost like in the inner light, except it's not gonna put anyone in a lifelong, you know, horrifying, you know, hologram reality. And our flotation boy is clearly lonely, and it's starting to want more for itself. And finally, she tries to contact the satellite, sends out like a radio signal because she can do that. And the satellite is like, "Oh, hello. I am here to introduce any new life forms who may have come to Earth. Are you a life form?" And the flotation boy says, "No." And the satellite says, "Oh, okay." And then it keeps going. And the flotation boy's like, "Damn it!" So the flotation boy now needs to pretend to be a life form in order to actually have any sort of interaction with the only other thing that is capable of interacting with it. And it starts, it's able to basically look into sort of the history of the internet and looks at like Instagram and YouTube and figures out this is what people were like.
Okay.
So when the next time she contacts the satellite, this flotation boy, who is voiced by Kristen Stewart, says it is a life form, and it's interested in sharing life form stuff with this satellite, who's voiced by Steven Yeun. And the thing is, the flotation boy doesn't know a goddamn thing about what life is like. It only knows what it's seen through YouTube videos, and it's just trying to copy what it saw as a perfect relationship between two humans before humanity died, who were played by Kristen Stewart and Steven Yeun.
Okay.
So she creates, like, a digital avatar of herself. And so a lot of the movie's animated.
Okay.
It looks like Metaverse, kind of. And they create in, like, their in the internet like that
Nintendo Miis, kind of stuff.
Yeah, basically they recreate a space from one of the YouTube videos that the Kristen Stewart flotation boy glommed onto. And they're trying to experience humanity by just reliving the same YouTube clip over and over again. Mm. Until Kristen Stewart finally says, "We got it right."
Okay.
But this, as they keep doing this over and over again, cycling over and over, God knows how many times, Steven Yeun starts realizing this isn't satisfying. This doesn't feel genuine.
Okay.
This isn't us. And I would like to do something different. And this pisses her off because her entire perspective about what happiness and connection and love is like are based off of what they've seen.
Yeah.
And what they've seen is very superficial. And this creates a rift, and I will not tell you how everything goes. I will say at one point, 1 billion years passes in this movie.
I love it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I love the concept of this movie.
Uh-huh.
It's so unapologetically uncinematic in its premise. Because it sounds like it should just be like two little machines pinging each other.
It sounds like a short story.
It really probably would be better as a short story. And I think it kind of struggles to fill a complete feature-length runtime. And the other thing that's kind of fascinating about this is that it really raises a lot of questions about artificial intelligence, what does it mean to be human, and it has zero interest in any of those things. Which, honestly, that's well-trodden territory. If you have something else you want to focus on, knock yourself out. And what the movie does focus on, ultimately, is the idea that our sense of self is so often defined by what we witness and what we experience and what popular culture drives into us, that a lot of us are completely unaware of who we are. And that's a fair point. Might not it might be a bit much to make this long a sci-fi film about it.
Okay.
But it's a fair point, and I think ultimately the movie comes to some very sweet, very zen, some very difficult conclusions about the absolute impossibility of meaningful connection, even though it is absolutely possible and we're mostly just getting in our own way.
Yeah.
Because we're trying to force people to be who they're not, or trying to force ourselves to be who we're not, or we're so concerned about fitting what our expectations of a relationship is that we have no idea what relationship we're actually in.
Yeah.
These are valid concepts. We maybe didn't need to go to this much trouble to explore that, but we did, and I like it. I don't love it. I think it gets too big for its own britches, but I think Stephen Yeun and Kristen Stewart, oh, thank you. Now that we're almost over, thank you, refrigerator. I'm sorry. Are you in love with the toaster? I don't have a toaster. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I don't have a toaster for you to love, refrigerator. Anyway, my point is this. If you like Stephen Yeun and Kristen Stewart, this is a good movie to see because it's just them, basically.
Right.
A lot of it's animated. Eventually, some of it is not. But they have to carry the whole movie, and they do so beautifully.
Yeah.
It's a good high concept, and it ultimately doesn't explore every single thing that it raises, but what it does explore, whether it's what you're interested in or not, it does do very well.
Mm.
But it does feel kind of padded. So, yeah. I like it, I don't love it, but okay. I do think that if any of that intrigues you, it's definitely worth checking out.
Definitely, I'm definitely intrigued.
Yeah, it's certainly intriguing. Like, it's certainly, like... You may be surprised just by how odd it is, I imagine, this is one of the movies where if you clicked on it without knowing anything about it, I can only imagine how weird it would be.
Right.
To watch this movie discover itself, but, anyway, I dig it, I don't love it, but that's pretty good for January. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We are going to review our movies now on a scale of C- to C+, that is the Critically Acclaimed way. C- is the lowest a movie can get. That's a movie we don't recommend for one reason or another. Maybe we just don't think it's very good. Maybe we think it's awful. C is an average movie. These are movies that are just okay. Bit of a mixed bag. And then C+ is an above average movie. This is a movie that we recommend. Maybe we even love it, but we certainly recommend it. On that note, Love Me is a high C.
Okay.
It's certainly, it's close to being like fascinating, but I think it does some interesting things, and if it wasn't so long, it probably would have justified its narrow focus a bit better, I think. But it's definitely not a wash. Presence.
Presence is a C+, not a very passionate C+. I think it functions very well. I like the approach to the filmmaking, and I like the perspective gimmick.
Yeah.
It's not too much more sophisticated than that, but it does function the way it does.
Fair
enough. Well,
it functions the way it does.
It functions the way it does. It's the most nondescript way I could have praised a movie.
When we write a book about film criticism, that's going to be how it functions the way it does.
Functions
quote
the way it
Whitney
does.
Seibold. You're welcome. A Companion is a big old C+. If you skip the review,
sorry, because I missed this one.
Yeah, if you skip the review because I told you might not want to know about it and just watch it unfold. To watch it unfold is a delight. It is. Wicked, twisted, funny, creates some rules and then like finds every way to follow and then break them in a way that makes sense for the narrative and never feels like a cheat. It's got really good performances. Jack Quaid's really great in particular. It's just a solid, entertaining surprise of a flick, and I hope you can preserve as much of the surprise as you can because it's fun. Let's see. Dogman
is C.
Oh, okay. I thought you were higher on it than that.
No, I liked it a lot. I think it functions well. I think it is a little bit slight. I used the word frantic a couple of times because I think it does race through certain sequences.
Especially the beginning
and the end. Pretty
quickly.
Like it introduces things really quickly. It wraps up really quickly. And then but it's like weirdly emotionally strong throughout the middle. So.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's a C. I think it's a C. I think this is a movie that I think if I was a little kid, I would really love.
Yeah.
But I can't give a review of what someone else would feel about a movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the caveat. If you have kids, they may like it a lot more than I did. If you grew up with these books, I don't know how long they've been around. Mm. How long have these Dog Man books been around?
About a decade now.
Yeah. Okay, so someone could conceivably have read them as a kid and now they're an adult.
Yeah.
Then you may have more affection for them than I do. But I was impressed by just how kind of soulful it was, and the emotional beats were the things that stuck with me a lot more than even the funnier jokes. But it's a sweet movie. It's a sweet movie. I just don't love it. And then lastly, Section 31, which I abstained from, even though I saw it. We talked about it a little bit, but I'm just going to not review it. Whitney, you get to have you get to have every word.
It's a C minus.
Oh no.
It doesn't have any of the stuff I like about Star Trek in it. And even that aside, I think it's not a very good action film.
Man.
I think the characters aren't very interesting, and I think the plot is incredibly boring.
Well, that's not a good review. I mean, it's an effective review. Don't get me wrong. It's definitely not a positive one.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week with a review of the new Amy Schumer comedy on Netflix. What's it called? Like Kind of Pregnant, Almost Pregnant, something like that.
I think it's called Kind of Pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah, also the Kei Kwee Kwan is back with a action comedy called Love Hurts. Which, you know, I hope is good. I don't really know anything about it, but I'll be seeing it soon. So that will be coming up next. Actually, before that, we've got a special episode of Critically Acclaimed this week in which Whitney and I talk about the best films of the century so far.
Yes.
If you're on Patreon, you can listen to that right now. For even just $1 a month, you can sign up for another tier and get a whole lot of exclusive stuff, or a whole Star Trek podcast, for example. You can listen to that now ad free and early, as we put out many of our episodes early out there. Or you can wait a few days and we'll put that out probably, I think, Thursday, on the main feed.
Yeah.
So if you can't wait, cool. Patreon's there for you. It's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Thank you to all of our patrons. We really appreciate you. Thank you to everyone once again for being patient. Again, January has been very destabilizing here in Los Angeles, and we're still struggling to get back up to like where we were productivity-wise, and also in terms of the space that we have access to. It's been it hasn't been ideal, but we're doing our best. And if you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
Yes.
We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box for those so inclined?
Yeah, send us a physical letter, send us a postcard, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Do it today. That's a wrap. We don't do that here. That's a different podcast. But anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you for listening. Never forget, everyone is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?